America's policy of separating religion and government has given us, here in the United States, more religious freedom than any nation in the history of the world.
And so you reconfigure the whole religious landscape so that people are looking for ministers whom they can trust for spiritual counsel on the basis of the political identity of that congregation. People don't deserve that, and this nation doesn't need that.
It was back in May of 2002 that the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Oversight heard testimony from Reverend Welton Gaddy, then president of Interfaith Alliance, and Reverend Barry Lynn, executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. At issue then were IRS rules on political activity by tax-exempt religious institutions, an issue that has unexpectedly roared back into the headlines with Donald Trump's stated intention to totally destroy the Johnson Amendment. We need to get some background on this unexpected assault on the separation of church and state. And so Barry Lynn is with us once again on State of Belief Radio. Reverend Lynn, welcome back to the show.
It's very nice to be here.
So I wonder if you could just start by helping our listeners understand the purpose and the practice of the Johnson Amendment since it was enacted in 1954.
Lyndon Johnson and many other of his colleagues were very concerned about the specific problem of charitable organizations, including religious organizations, religious foundations, that seemed to be collecting money not for the public good, but in Lyndon Johnson's case, solely to collect money to help his opponent in the upcoming Senate race. So there's nothing secret about this. I think America's charities, and including religious organizations, have been granted tax-exempt status because they're perceived as doing some public good, making up for perhaps lost opportunities by government to, or willingness by governments to provide services. So this was not a big controversy. It was studied the year before, the Congress before the Johnson Amendment was passed, so it wasn't unknown to the people who voted overwhelmingly for it, nor was it controversial when President Dwight Eisenhower signed it. So this is something across the board, any charity, any religious organization, anyone with a tax-exempt status, a 501c3 status, cannot do one thing, and that is endorse or oppose candidates for public office. Donald Trump decided to revive it. I heard him speak about this once to a group of about 3,000 or 4,000 evangelicals, and he said, "I am going to get rid of the Johnson Amendment." And then he said as an aside, which I guess he thought was funny, he said, getting rid of this is the only way I'm going to get into heaven. And okay. To which I say, he ought to know. But evangelicals love this. I mean, this is the biggest thing on the minds of evangelical organizations, not necessarily evangelical churches, because in poll after poll, not just do Americans like this rule, but the clergy in this country really likes this rule because they don't want to become cogs in some kind of political action committee. They don't want to be encouraged by politicians to help them, support them in order to get some kind of benefit. They'd rather not have that temptation. The public's overwhelmingly against it. Just this week, Politico here in Washington published an in-depth study of a lot of issues, including this one, and it's clear that an overwhelming majority of Americans do not want churches to become politicized. They like the law the way it is.
So you've mentioned that this is probably coming from evangelical organizations rather than churches themselves. I'm just wondering, why is there so much interest on the political religious right in getting rid of this? And do you think it may actually end up being an intra-evangelical battle between some of the organizations on one side and some of the churches on the grassroots on the other?
I wouldn't be surprised if this became a kind of internecine warfare between major evangelical organizations that do not want to get involved in politics in a partisan way, and others that are more interested in that. I think that it's safe to say that if you go to a church and the only thing your rabbi, pastor, imam, priest has to say is who to vote for, that perhaps that individual has not been carefully considering the broad theological issues for which people go to those religious institutions. Nobody needs a pastor to tell them who to vote for all the way from the city council to the presidency of the United States. I don't go to church to listen to people pontificate about who I should vote for. And it is important, and one of the reasons this has become a big issue, people don't understand that the only prohibition is against the endorsement or opposition to a candidate for public office. Any religious institution today can, in fact, talk virtually in an unlimited manner about any political issue, as long as they don't tie it to a partisan vote for this person or don't vote for that one.
So I've heard some of the propaganda about the Johnson Amendment and framed in the context of religious liberty and free speech, that this is a gag rule that's restricting speech. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's not a gag rule because we have, shall we say, enormous pulpit freedom, as Baptists and others say. And the evidence of that is on a day that back in the 90s, when this came up in the Congress, I was watching the television in the morning before going to church, and I happened to see Jesse Jackson on. And then I saw Jerry Falwell on, and I thought, in a country where Jerry Falwell can talk about the issues he wants and Jesse Jackson can talk about the same issues with a very different perspective, I'd say we have a great deal of freedom of speech from the pulpit. It's also, just as a technical matter, the Supreme Court's made it clear that there are circumstances under which you can constrain, that is to say, limit the speech of people who get a federal benefit. Tax exemption is an enormously valuable benefit, and all one has to do is suggest that somebody might want to not get a tax exemption if you're a church, or again, it's not just churches, it's charities, it's educational groups. They don't want to give up that tax exemption. It's too valuable. So in exchange for this incredibly valuable benefit from the government, the only thing that these charities have to do that fundamentally constrains them as all is not to endorse or oppose candidates. They can talk about issues, but they cannot endorse candidates. I don't think this country needs another giant loophole in what is left of our system of regulating political activity. We already have driven home all kinds of holes in it. The Citizens United decision that allowed so many corporations to endorse candidates. We have 527 organizations, 501c4 organizations, so-called social welfare groups. These are all, in my personal opinion, the best thing that could happen is we'd have two kinds of organizations. We would have people who run political candidates' own operations, and then we would have charities. And in the middle, we wouldn't have these mixed entities like 527s. And if the churches became eligible for continued tax exemption, even if they endorsed candidates, the very next thing that they would do, because under Citizens United, of course, speech is money, we would see this phenomenon of money laundering through the churches. People would say, well, I can't get a tax break if I give money to Senator Smith, but if I just give $10,000 to a church and the church passes it on to Senator Smith, I'm in the clear. I've made a contribution. I can take a charitable deduction, and it still ends up in the coffers of Senator Smith. And that is a horrendous idea. That is not what the religious institutions of America ought to be about.
I wrote an article for the Daily Beast a few months ago talking to some of the architects of Citizens United, and probably most of our listeners don't know that, you know, a lot of that political activism really did begin in the political religious right, that it was not just kind of the libertarian Koch brothers camp that was doing it, but it actually came out of some of the religious right organizations precisely for the reason that you mentioned. You know, I just wonder if you could tell us briefly what you think the odds are now. How hopeful are you that there's a way to prevent the repeal of this, and what can folks do to get involved?
Yeah, I mean, I really think that this is an issue where you're going to find not just a huge amount of Democratic opposition, but also Republicans who are very distressed about the idea that some new campaign finance loophole will be created, that it will besmirch the purpose of religious institutions in this country and drag them into the sometimes unsavory acts of partisan politics. I think many people, they like to go to their place of worship. They just as soon not smell cigar smoke wafting up from the basement where a group of the leaders of the church are figuring out where their endorsements can come and how much money can be given to those candidates. Now, the people who want this repeal, they're not willing to admit at this point that if you allow speaking from the pulpit, distributing campaign literature under the windshield wipers of cars in the church parking lot, that that necessarily means that they will make contributions, financial contributions. But I think it's only a hair's breadth of a difference. And I think that shortly after this would happen, there would be the same people, as you rightly point out, from the religious right, who love Citizens United, would love to say, oh, by the way, now we too, the church, can make those contributions, and they will be invisible to the people who look at them.
Wondering if, as we close, if you could talk for a minute about some of the other priorities that Americans United is focused on. Obviously, with this administration, it's easy to get overwhelmed. I'm just curious, what are some of the, you know, top two or three priorities that you're focused on right now?
Sure. We've had a number of our attorneys working with attorney generals around the country on this immigration ban, which is clearly designed to keep Muslims out and to allow Christians in from some of these countries in the Middle East. I think that we've yet to see the final resolution of these questions, but I think it's unquestionable that the purpose of Donald Trump was to harm immigrants who happen to be Muslim and to prefer those who happen to be Christian. So we're working on that. We did a lot of work on the unfortunate fact that Betsy DeVos is now the Department of Education chair, Jeff Sessions is now the Attorney General. These are people of absolutely no respect for the separation of church and state. And I think that the vote on both of those candidates, though, does indicate that there is a loyal opposition. It's usually most in the Democratic Party and a few Republicans who also understand that the rights of the people, particularly their religious freedom, should not be hampered by the forces of government. So there are plenty of things to do. I'm always delighted to work with the Interfaith Alliance and our sister and brother organizations to make sure that these issues are given the attention that they deserve. And I am not sanguine, but I am optimistic that as the bullying continues by some in the White House, that people will start to wake up and say, perhaps Donald Trump, although he was elected with 81% of evangelicals voting for him, perhaps Donald Trump's ideas are not in the highly moral and highly ethical category, and a hard look needs to be taken at them.
Reverend Barry Lynn is the longtime executive director of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. He tells the story of his time in that position so far in his book, God and Government, 25 Years of Fighting for Equality, Secularism, and the Freedom of Conscience. Reverend Lynn, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Rabbi.